Hey, what's up, Adam? Welcome to the pod.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's great to do this, man. So, Adam Ryan, you're the founder of Workweek. Give us a brief introduction of like who you are, what you're doing.
Started Workweek November of 2021, and we saw an opportunity to help what we industry experts, people that work and operate day to day in roles such as being a chief people officer or chief growth officer. And those people are the pulse of the industry, right? They know what is going on. They know the best practices. They, in real time, are learning what actually works. And we saw a pretty big gap in the quality of content going out in this B2B space around those ICPs, where if you are in HR, there's a lot of HR news, a lot of HR journalists, which like that plays a role. But we think there's this knowledge expert paradox where operators with the best insights and experiences didn't actually have the time or skill set or capital to build real media businesses. And so we partner with industry experts and help them build brands and audiences and products that then supports those audiences. And we think because of their own expertise, that content is best in category and will ultimately help us build a really big business.
It's awesome. We always ask people, give us a sense of the business. So for you, it's going to be a little bit more complicated because we talked to a lot of people who have one newsletter, one media company, or one publication, rather.
Right.
How many newsletters or publications do you have, or creators, however you classify it?
Yeah.
And if you can give us a sense, I don't know if you share this anymore. I know you used to, but if you can give us a sense of subscriber numbers or audience size, that would be helpful too.
Yeah. So I don't count mine because I'm the worst of the group. So we have 10 newsletters besides my own that we support. And from and then I think seven podcasts. Last year we did 75 events, one conference, four summits. So a lot of things going on there. We from a subscriber perspective are today around 510,000.
That's awesome. Do you share revenue numbers? I know you've done this in the past on Twitter, but is that
Yeah.
just something you do?
I mean, I give our 2-year update where I shared in October we did about, a little over 1.1 million. The month before that we did about 950. This year, 2024, we see our non-ad revenue growing about 4 to 5x, which I haven't shared before. So that's like the most promising aspect of the business. We're not adding any new brands is the plan this year. We think we have just absolute winners in our in stable, and we're not doing enough to maximize the potential of those. And so this year we're focusing on those, and ad revenue will probably 2x, and then non-ad will 4 to 5. So that's where it's at.
That's awesome. And that's great context. I'm curious, so with non-ad revenue growing as fast as it is, and it seems like a lot of the focus is there right now, I think a lot of newsletter operators and media operators in general are really thinking through options outside of sponsorship revenue and ad revenue. Like, what are the experiments that you and the team are running or have run? What are some big lessons that you've taken away on the monetization side?
Yeah, I mean, I've been like in the content to commerce space since MyFitnessPal and Under Armour a long time ago. And so it's always something that's like not new, right? I think it's like one of these trends that every like creator walks in, they're like, oh, I have this idea. It's like literally a lot of people have done that before. And it's I think the funny part is like the lessons aren't any different than they were 10 years ago. It's one, like you are not going to sell anything unless your content sparks emotion and is trusted. And, advertising is a leading indicator of that. And I think this is like the underrated aspect of ads, right? Of having good quality advertisers too, right? If you have advertisers in B2B saying, this is the fucking best channel I've ever been on, I love it, I'm back, right? It's a pretty good indicator you could probably do something on your own, right? That you could probably sell something on your own. And I don't think people give enough credit to that. On the ads front. And because essentially what my lesson is, every ask that you have of the audience is just one last ask in that life cycle, right? Like there is not infinite asks. So every ask that you give them, it's one less. And then you have to do an assessment of like, what value are we capturing from every ask? And so like you have an ad in there, helps you make some money today. Great. Okay, now I want to build a course. I want to do this. I want to build a product. Great. What is the value that you're going to capture from there? And I think some people miscalculate that in a pretty large way once they consider the cost to build and execute. And I would instead just like use other leading indicators of your advertisers as essentially like a profitable way to understand it. So that's like number one. So we learned that lesson. We like launched things to audiences that weren't prepared to buy. That content, that emotion wasn't there. So that's like one thing is double checking. And I think the next one, and this is like applies to us more, but I think it's in general, but like never forget who the ICP is, right? Like there's, I think this world of up and to the right newsletter subscribers is like such a bad place to be. And it just totally reminds me of like the page view era of 2013-14, and everyone's like hacking their way to do it. And, you know, we track like, hey, how many people are directors and aboves and match our exact ICP? And we have a chart that tracks it. And like, if it falls below a certain number, like, whoa, we're having an issue. And like, I can promise you no one's doing that, that shares all those Twitter graphs going up in the right. And this is like in the details, but like, they're going to just have like a shit business model or none. It's like one of the two. And I think it's not just like your emotional content and spark, but it's also obviously a unit economics business. I think that's, you know, focusing on your ICP, making sure that you're building for that audience, you're sustaining that audience, that you have unit economics that match. And then of course, whatever products you launch in the future, it actually solves a problem with theirs.
Yeah. Let's dive into some of those things. So could you maybe walk us through if you're thinking about launching a product or service or whatever it might be for one of your verticals or publications, is there like a process for that? Do you do surveys, interviews? Do you like do a test launch?
Yeah.
What do you do to figure that out?
You know, it's not that different than what we did at The Hustle. We survey, we test. I mean, like Trends was like our success story when we were there. But like what people don't know is we launched this like huge job thing that was a total failure like 8 months before that. And it didn't sell at all. And we canceled it. And we like thought that was going to be a big thing. And so, you know, same thing, like take baby steps. Don't jump in all the way. If you think you can like sell $1,000 course, like go make a guide and see how many people download it, right? Like if you want to throw a big conference, like do a free meetup, like take baby steps along the way. And I think that also like, you know, we're in this like ADHD solopreneur era, and like taking a step back and allowing people to be like, okay, I'm going to actually focus on like the user journey and the product strategy of this helps a lot. And doing that bit by bit is much better than like saying like, look, I did this thing, and it's like, cool, you shouldn't have done that first. And you know, The Hustle is a good example. We did literally dozens of free events before like HustleCon reached 1,000+ people, right? So we've taken the same strategy at Workweek of like you just build bit by bit, and then all of a sudden you're not actually, you know, you research and you talk to customers, you like tease products in small ways. And then all of a sudden you reach this point where people are actually asking for the thing that you originally wanted to build. Like they're already there. You've like built that product market fit before you've even built it, because like they're asking for it. And that's like the moment to move forward.
Have you found any insights or patterns on product types? So have you found events work better, or courses or memberships, communities, SaaS? You have a SaaS product now. Or have you found any like audience to product matches that work well in your experience or not? You know, let us know.
Yeah. So we have a franchise vertical SaaS business. We have a recruiting agency service business that does like executive recruiting. We have a $3,000 a year membership subscription. We have a $400 a year membership subscription, two different verticals. And then we threw Marketing Land, which was a massive conference at the ACL festival. So we kind of tested all the things last year. What I told the team in our State of the Union was 2023 was our year of testing intention. Would people actually like buy the shit because they actually like have intention with us? And you know, luckily we think they did. Our non-ad revenue grew a lot. Then you take the next step back, like, cool, people will buy it, but like, which ones should we do more of, right? Which ones are the best? And I think the lesson there is like goes to twofold. I think as if you're a media company, it's like, what is actually something that helps your core competency? So like anything around data, information, community, like those things are like natural extenders of what you do. I think the SaaS, there's a whole bunch of SaaS and agency stuff popping up, and we're in that too. It fundamentally is just a really big challenge. I'm not saying people are going to make good money on it. I mean, like you guys are doing a podcast, you both have agencies, like you understand why you do that. It can work, right? But like it is not as linear as some of these other products. It requires, like, if we think about sales-led growth, marketing-led growth, product-led growth, like those businesses are marketing and sales-led still. And like it makes it really tough to scale. You're only as good as your last push, and that's fine. There's just like a difference of scalability and repeatability. And I think goals matter too. Like if someone's trying to create a lifestyle business to try to get to a couple $100,000 a year, an agency is probably like exactly what I would do. If you're trying to build something like more scalable and bigger than that, then you have to assess like how do we actually continue to grow and compound this business.
So if you could make a recommendation for a newsletter operator, media operator, would it be go towards the course membership and subscription offering, or can you get more specific on that?
Yeah. I mean, I think like, so courses, so like, just think about like why someone already subscribed to your content. Right. And so, you know, with, we do a ton of continuing education, like workforce education stuff. And like, it makes a total sense, right? Our B2B newsletters are all like very insights driven. It's like already there. We're just like doing fuel in the fire. And I think that's like, if you have a newsletter that like already is known for providing unique insights and education, people are responding to you, be like, oh my God, I just learned so much. I just like implemented this. Like you already have product market fit to go do that. So I think that's the assessment. Events is different. You know, geographical matter, like do you have worldwide or are you all in one city? Is it like United? Like that matters with events. Like we could do this at the Hustle So Easily because like vast majority of people in San Francisco. That was like a unique thing that I don't think at the time we like really realized how lucky that was. But like with Work Week, it was like a lot of these audiences are kind of spread all over. This is like harder to do. You know, they have to be more like almost like community driven, like they have to be self-organized versus us organized. And that's like a whole different thing. But I think, you know, if you're a consumer creator, getting people together shows, like if you're creating like entertainment and doing those things, like it shows that people actually care, because that's a really hard thing to do to drive people to like show up to someone. If you're creating more like business oriented content, I would just start with like dinners. Like, can you get 10 people to show up somewhere? You can get a sponsor to help pay for the dinner and everything. But like, I think those are, again, that's like the little things that you can do that like, hey, I rented out a room in a restaurant. I invited 10 people that I respect in my industry. They all showed up. We all had a good time. It was paid for. I'm going to do that 10 times this year. Well, next year I might do like an $800 one-day summit where all 100 of those people I'm going to invite, I'm going to get 30 people there. Boom, I have a $50,000 event, right? Like that's, and I think that's the kind of route I would take if I was a creator or media company kind of growing.
Yeah. One last question for me on that. Can you share if there's like one product at Workweek that's just kind of outperformed all the rest? Does that exist? And can you share what that is?
Yeah. I think our memberships are like by far the winning formula. The repeatability, then the like, you know, make money when you sleep kind of thing, right? Like people buy it, like wake up in the morning, like, oh, Stripe notification, like gotta love that, right? Also there's like, and this is a whole different aspect of it, but when you like assess the true, we're now, you know, we have 2 years of data. So like I have like cohort analysis by month, by product for 2 years, I can tell you what that does if someone signs up to be a member, if someone signs up to be, you know, et cetera. So that's, and it's powerful. It's like way stronger and better. And so there's like this whole aspect, I think, of that, of like, if someone signs up to, you know, get more of your content on any sort of like kind of membership level, that they're taking that step. I think it's probably been the thing that's been the fastest growing and the most successful. And it also, it still enables all those other things that come down later, right? Like it doesn't mean that those things have to go away. It actually potentially creates like even an easier funnel to sell those.
Yeah, I think, I mean, everything you outlined, I think that's a really approachable way for folks that are just getting started building products, is like slow iteration, baby steps, test something and then scale it. I also want to call back you mentioned, and I think you're right, that nobody else is really doing this. Nobody that I've worked with, and I'm sure maybe the case is correct with Matt as well. But keeping track of like Director Plus and using that as like a proportional metric that you guys are measuring against. And you mentioned kind of the up and to the right nature of a lot of the growth stats that folks are sharing around newsletters. I think it's safe to say that a lot of that is fueled by these recommendation platforms like Sparkloop, Beehive Boost, and you. I mean, I think earlier than a lot of other folks in the space. I remember last year you had a perpetual newsletter about Substack and the recommend and kind of the recommendation network there, and maybe the downsides to that. And then more recently, you had a back and forth with the founder of Sparkloop on Twitter. For folks that have missed those takes, like maybe you can summarize your take on recommendation platforms, and are they healthy for newsletters and kind of the ecosystem that's building right now? I guess what's your take on that?
Yeah, and give us a definition too of what they are.
Yeah. So the Substack one I wrote like about a year ago, like right when it came out, was I called it a Ponzi scheme, and I actually still fundamentally believe actually Substacks is probably still a Ponzi scheme. You could argue Spark. I don't know the data. I asked Lewis for it. I haven't seen it. But like, I believe that there are more people subscribing to more newsletters than people are entering the Substack ecosystem. And it's a closed system, just like Beehive and Substack. So Sparkloop's point, right? He said like, we're an open ecosystem. That's like how that whole conversation got started. Those platforms, Beehive is growing like crazy, and he shares those numbers and he shares how many people do the recommendations, and like they're balancing that. They did just go to 5. It used to be 3, so we'll see. But that was like, I think they've done a good job of like creating balance on that. But my whole original take, like very early before anyone like really was using it, was this is bad news for everyone, because Axios, like, this is not a new idea, first of all. Like, everyone, what they did was something that like every publisher that had numerous newsletters was already doing and trying. We did. We had a newsletter called Work Talk. It was like a broad business meme newsletter. People liked it a lot. If you sign, our CACs were lower because it's like a general business newsletter. And then on a referral, on sign up, if you said you were like in HR, we'd say like, hey, you want to sign up for this? The LTV sucked. Like overall, like the actual engagement around people that actively sign up for multiple things at once is just not effective long term. And I think everyone gets caught up in like them, but like, just think about humans. Think about our behaviors of like, if you get 3 emails in 5 minutes or you get 1 email in 5 minutes, which one's going to be more paid attention to? Like, it's just how it goes. And that's like, I think fundamentally people, and like the math that they shared and Lewis shared was like, he basically did this like cohort retention, which I really don't believe the metric that he shared, but he basically said that the cohort retention were the same for people who signed up for a referral, a recommended newsletter, and like the one they signed up for organically. He said they had the same churn rate, which like I would love to see that from anyone. If you guys were a lot of people, I would love to see that, because I think that is like a wildly off assumption. But he said they're the same. And then his point was like, hey, they're both 50% churn. And at the end of the year with 50% churn, it's still just like one active, you know, you like have one active subscriber per newsletter. And I was like, first of all, I don't believe those assumptions. But second, that's actually like still net negative, because we have today, I just actually got this number, which is a crazy number. On average, for our one newsletter, there are about 85,000 people. In 2 years, 60-something people total have unsubscribed and come back. Pretty low number for like 80-something thousand people. So if you don't make that impression on that first time and you're not building that habit, the likelihood that person ever comes back to you, you're absolutely screwed. So what everybody's happening is like, cool, look at my list growth, grow. And then the person can be like, shit, I'm like subscribed to all these newsletters now. I'm going to unsubscribe. And then the likelihood that they're later like, you know what, I'm going to go back to that one is not going to happen. So actually what you're doing is you're like flushing in all these subs. The churn rate is naturally higher because of quantity. And then that person is not going to come back to you. And then if you're actually tracking ICP, which is like, this is the point, right? If you're actually tracking ICP, you're losing the people that should be on your list for years. because like they're just overwhelmed. And so like that's like it just if you and this is, you know, I'm happy to share my data very publicly, and I've told Lewis and DMs that like I will show what we have of like on a 2-year cohort basis. We did this with somebody, and like our retention curves after month like 7 basically go to like our churn's like 0.2-0.3% a month, like net. The first 6 months, if you especially with paid channels, right, it's much higher. And like that's how it goes, right? But like after that, it goes. We have a newsletter that did this recommendation strategy, and like month 13 to 18, it was 4, 5, 6%. Like they're still churning all the time because like they don't have content market fit. And then you have this huge leaky bucket, which is like was my follow up to the Salesforce or the Substack newsletter, that you have this leaky bucket, and sooner or later, like all these newsletters and the Hustle was in this situation, right? Like Ryan knows, there's like, when my like last couple of months there, like we had to spend basically $100,000 a month to like not go backwards. And now you're like, well, this is tough. And now it's harder to get to profitability. And like, no one's thinking about that. And so anyway, those are the three things of like LTV. I think it's a terrible decision. And I love, if anyone has any other data, I'd love to be convinced, because I will invest a ton of money into it if it's different. But I also just think fundamentally, you're saturating the market so fast, you're rushing it, that your core ICP is going to fall off and you're not going to get them back on. And then downstream, you're going to have even worse engagement. And like, there's just, you know, I think to summarize the last thing is like, he said on the tweet, he was like, look, don't we just want more people to read quality newsletters? And I was like, not really, right? Like, no, you do, because ConvertKit gets paid for sends, right? I don't, and no publisher should. No, it's not. So like, it is an incentive problem, right? And they're incentivized to get lists very high and grow. I want people that are in my ICP to read my newsletter, and the less competition there is, the better, right? That's like, and anyone that says differently is lying. And every bit of attention that gets pulled somewhere else is ultimately hurting the wider ecosystem. And I think that's like what we're kind of dealing with and experiencing.
Yeah, let's dig into this. I think one thing I learned from Kendall Baker, who used to work at Axios and The Hustle and is now at Yahoo, is like the inbox is unique in content, where people are a lot more sensitive to what's in there versus, you know, you can subscribe to 100 YouTube channels. You're still going to look at your discovery page, and it's not going to affect you too much. Same thing with podcasts, but the email inbox is unique in that way, where it's a lot more sensitive. And so to explain like how these work for people who haven't seen them before, it's like you sign up for a newsletter, and then after you sign up, they recommend usually 5 other newsletters that you can sign up for too. You can say yes or no, or you can select which ones you want to sign up for. But usually these recommendations are default on. And so if you click yes, you're automatically subscribed to 5 other newsletters. So now you just joined 6 instead of 1.
Yeah. And usually, Substack for a while auto-opted you in. They changed that because there was a I rang that bell pretty loud, but I was like, this is literally a horrible, horrible thing to auto-opt in. But that was even worse. Like, that's okay, great. 1 new person in, 6 people out. And my point to that, by the way, and if you are a content creator that is growing organically, and when I mean organically, you're not working with people like Matt and Ryan, you're not doing recommendations. Like, I'm talking like you post shit on Twitter, you start with 500, you get to 1,000, 1,500, like you truly have organic growth. Your list is getting exploited and it's going to crush you later. And if you're a top Substack person that actually grew organically 30, 50,000 people, all your people just got totally put on 1 million other people's lists. Like, it hurts you. You're the top 1%. Substack, once again, forgot their business model, which they make all of it from the people that make the most money. They punished all those people from a user perspective.
Can you break that down? So if you're growing organically and you're recommending other newsletters, that's why your engagement's degrading, because now they just put your newsletter and 5 more?
Or what do you mean? Yeah, so I'll give you like a concrete example. So like we work with a newsletter at Workweek, right? It is fucking maybe the best newsletter I've ever seen from an economics perspective. It is like unbelievable. Advertisers return so good. It's about 40,000 subs. Makes about $300, $250 to $300 net CPMs across the newsletter every cent. Crazy. A lot of money. And sells out. People love it. Huge CTRs. Just great. I mean, it's just amazing. Also, about 85, 90% of list complete organic, like direct or social, which that's right. That's the thing. Introducing paid into that equation, which just like take this as an example, introducing paid into the exam, and we increase list size by 30%. So now you're like, cool, 30% more inventory. We can make 30% more money. CPMs dropped 30% because engagement, ICP, right? These are lessons we've learned, right? Engagement, ICP, CTR, all that went down. Advertisers are like, I'm just buying a bigger list with like the same results as I did like 3 months ago. Recommendations are no different. So like if you're a newsletter writer, one of the few that like truly have cracked content market fit and people love it, you making the decision to allow other people to get access to that list, think about your own selves again, put yourself as a human. How many, do you read 7 newsletters? No. Do you read 4? Probably not. Maybe 2, right? Like we're already lucky if you read half. That's like really what we're saying. You introduce more, you're going to hurt yourself. Keep that list yourself as much as humanly possible. Like delay that completely. You'll lower churn rate. And so that's, I think people get caught up and they do this math equation of like, look, I mean, this is like how I think, like sub count, revenue per user, revenue, right? Like that's the formula. What people think is like revenue per user stays the same if sub count just goes way up, and it's not, it's going to drop. And like sometimes I tweeted this and I didn't mean to like call anyone specifically out. It was really about our own team. But like, you know, there's 500,000 HR people in the United States across all levels. And like knowing your TAM, by the way, step one, if you're going to go build an audience and want to make it, but 500,000 HR people, that list has 117,000 people that we have, 67% or something like that have said they're in HR. So we have like 70,000 people, almost all of them in the United States. Well, like that's 20% plus of market share. Like that's killer. Before we grow anymore, like let's capitalize on that, right? Because all we're going to do is actually just like every month that they're good, every ask that you have, every send that you do, you're going to lose somebody. And so like, there's also to this point where I think the other thing that these successful writers have is they don't realize how much potential you can get from so little. And like that, I just met someone who has a newsletter list of 4,000 people of product marketers, and she's making a couple hundred grand a year in subscription and ads, 4,000 people. That's like, she's smart. She knew what she was doing. She's like, I'm gonna take my time and monetize correctly. I think everyone's just trying to like cheat code their way to like more subs equals either easier ad revenue, but they're really just going to collapse the revenue over time.
Yeah. I think the point you're making is just the quality of the audience is important above everything else. And yeah, I mean, just one more, I guess, question or note on this topic. I think the stance for a lot of folks, you know, that are involved in the recommendation platforms is that it's not co-reg. I know that we've tested co-registration, or it's somehow different from other co-registration channels. I know that we tested it at The Hustle and co-registration. So maybe just really quickly, if you could just explain.
That was said and I sent him a message. I was not meaning co-reg. I mean, I'm meaning like I've tested our own recommendation features.
Yeah.
I've seen it. Axios, if you want to go talk to their like former head of growth that was there in the early days, he used to do it, destroyed LTV. Like there's like publications have done this on their own for a long time. And to think like it changes because of tech is silly. And so no, I was not meaning co-reg. I was meaning like recommendations or whatever kind of name you want to call it.
100%. And co-reg is often more incentivized for some people who a lot of people don't even know what co-reg is. Like often it's like, enter to win a free iPhone. And then every newsletter or everything you sign up for, you get additional entries to win. Like that would be one example.
I mean, like the number one co-reg we used at The Hustle was job board sites. And that was like by far the number. I mean, I think we probably added 200,000 people from that on the list. I mean, it was like number one.
And churned most of them too.
And they almost all churned, right? Well, like I think we used bull.org and it was just awful. And so that's, yeah, I don't, That's not what I mean. The intent of that is quite different, right? I like recognize like when someone signs up for a newsletter, that intent is high. And that's what like they're capitalizing on. My point is it just doesn't make good business unit economic sense if you like actually look at the data.
Okay. Yeah. I guess that was my question was how similar is it to CoReg? But you're saying that it's because of the intent, it's not as similar.
Yeah, it's definitely more valuable than CoReg. But the scale that this is happening at is the problem, like, and the number, right? If it was one-to-one, where like you only offered one, you're like, this is it, and it didn't overlap, and they had like parameters in place, I actually think there's like that creates like enough boundaries and constraints that like it's not in this like Ponzi scheme phase, and it's not overwhelming inboxes where you get like multiple welcome emails, and it's like, okay, you signed up for this thing, this one other one you might like, I think it'd be fine. That's just those SaaS companies are incentivized by growing those lists. So they just go to, now they do five. They auto opt them in. They just want people to add it to the list and they don't care about the LTV downstream. That's just like not how it is.
We've seen about, I don't have LTV numbers for every one of our clients because we don't always have access to that. We're usually seeing them at like 150 to a 200% higher click-through rate from like a Facebook ad subscriber versus a paid recommendation subscriber. So 200% higher click-through rate. And then some other people who write agencies who have more insight to LTV have talked to me and said they're usually seeing from free and paid recommendations versus organic. Organic has about a 10x higher LTV. And it sounds like you might have seen similar.
Oh, for sure. I mean, like easily. It's just like, I would do it. This is what this is, right? I would do it if I could go get Lenny's audience for $1.50. Yeah, I'll take those newsletter subscribers, but I don't want to give them any of mine. Like, you know, like, I mean, there's an equation on the other side that makes it like worth it, right? It can grow for a certain CAC and like the engagement's still going to be worse. But like, what my point of view is like, why would someone who has a successful newsletter opt into that? From a successful growth channel, like, you know, all those things considered, it still is a numbers game of like, is it good math or not? I just don't think. And it's fair, the product hasn't been around long enough to do this, but like if you truly took like a deep cohort analysis of those over time, to your point, Matt, I think you're going to just see massive, massive churn.
I think the one devil's advocate thing is a lot of people, not really devil's advocate, but just another way people are using this is they're bootstrapping a newsletter-focused business. They want to use paid acquisition to grow, so they're buying subscribers with Facebook ads for $2, and they're making maybe $1 per subscriber from Sparkloop or another paid recommendation, and it just allows them to earn back or make that payback period shorter. Yeah. So that's a lot of the behavior that I'm seeing.
There's other ways to do that. Just do lead gen. Just do like, there's so many other ways to do that. Do offer a $10 guide in your drip. Like there's 1,000 ways to do that same thing if you like put a little bit of effort into it without sacrificing the quality of your list. But actually on the flip side, you actually understand who has the highest intent. And like, that's how we view onboarding is like, I'm trying to identify my top 10%, not lose my top 10%. And that's like the difference of the strategy. And yeah, I think the other factor, which like I said this and Beehive guy was actually really cool about it. Cause I was kind of like, I love Beehive. I was an investor in Sparkloop too. And this, so like, we love the referral program. We're still customers, by the way, for Spark referral. Like if you need an open source referral, I think they're like best. What I'm talking about is recommendation stuff where I have my disagreement with them. But Beehive is amazing and great. But I kind of said as like, look, they were like kind of pumping about like, it's never been easier to get your first 1,000 subs. And I was like, is this just like going to make it impossible to tell if people actually have content market fit? Because it used to be for us, there's like two levels. How long does it take to get to 1,000 organic subs? And how long does it take to 10,000 organic subs? And you should do 10,000 organic within 12 months and you have a fucking banger of a newsletter. Like you're going to have a monster. And that was like a very clear proven data strategy that we had worked out. And like now, you know, and I could assess other newsletters too. Like if I wanted to have them join Workweek and everything, there's like a lot of things that made it easier. Today, that's like a lot harder to do and people are gaming the system more. And it's like, they're sending these false signals of like, oh, my newsletter's so good. Look at it. And it's like, could be. Like, I'm not saying no, but I'm not as confident as I used to be based on those signals.
Yeah, we're going to get 10,048 hours. But
yeah,
there's Sparkloop. Yeah. There's something else. One question that is, I talked to so many people on Substack in particular that are like, I don't want to leave Substack because 40 or usually between like 40 to 70% of my free subscribers and paid subscribers are coming from Substack's recommendation network or platform. If you were an operator in that situation, like what do you do? You probably wouldn't get in that situation, but like, what do you think about that? Because that's, I swear, most of the top people on Substack are in that situation of where the, because their growth is coming from those sources, that source rather.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there's also always exceptions to the rule. Like, I think Lenny writes like maybe the best newsletter like ever, right? Like, it's so good. So like, some people can make this work right on the receiving end because like their product is superior. And everyone else they then gave them is screwed, right? That's like that's the flip side of it. If I had 40% of my list from referrals, I would want to start to identify who are my top users, like immediately. I'd start to do polls and surveys and engagement and downloads and guides and like whatever it is, like show intention. And like ask yourself, like, am I optimizing for attention or intention? It's like something we talk all about at Work Week all the time. But like intention builds businesses, attention builds egos. And I if 40% of my list was in this like kind of hacky way, I would almost immediately try to see who can I cut off of that like isn't good and who can I keep. And that's identifying titles, that's identifying actions, et cetera.
You've mentioned a few metrics. You've mentioned the ICP kind of proportion, like the proportion of the list that are ICPs. And you mentioned kind of organic growth numbers. Like going back to that scenario that you just mentioned of, you know, if you were looking at a newsletter and trying to qualify them for Work Week, what are some other metrics that you would look at? Like, how would you value a newsletter like that? Like, we know
that depends on the life cycle. It depends on the life cycle. I mean, like, I think the organic growth is number one by far. Yeah. Like, I mean, go talk to any investor, right, about like any product market fit, and they're like, is there organic growth? Like, where is it coming from? Is it word of mouth and referral? Like, boom, great. It's no different with content. The second aspect is like, you know, and this gets into like my preferences versus others, but like, you know, something I realize and why we chose to get into like B2B niche B2B topics is because like I kind of fundamentally believe that building an audience for children's entertainment versus franchising is actually like equally hard. But the unit economics on the franchising side is about 1,000 times better. And so the second thing I look at is like, who is the actual audience that subscribes and like, what is that content like superior? Right. I think, you know, the last kind of hidden result thing that we talk about is like, how many people are responding to that newsletter? It's such like another clever way to see content market fit, is, are people engaging? Do they care? Do you like bring emotion out? Do you like have them be like this? I look forward to this. Like those are the things. And honestly, 1, 2, 3 of those is like the little fire that you have to just build on. Like even if you like have a newsletter of 7,000 people and 2 people write you back, like who are those 2 people? Like why do they write back? How do you find more of those people? And that's like what I always look for.
You mentioned B2B versus B2C, or like that example, which I love. You talked a lot about Miss Rachel too, which we won't get into, but
I love
that's another great like media property, if we want to call it that. Okay, so let's dive into that conversation. But let's start with the thesis behind Work Week. Like, why did you pick Work Week? Why did you pick B2B versus something else? You previously worked at The Hustle, which I think we would describe as like a B2C media company that covers.
I call it prosumer.
Prosumer?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I always called it prosumer. It's like, I think it like had, I mean, if you look at it, I call it prosumer based on like ad rates. It had, you know, it was like not consumer. It wasn't in like the 10, 12 range. It wasn't like the 50 to 100 range. It was like in the 20, 25 for ad spend. So it was like kind of prosumery. Also, our top advertisers were like Salesforce and Monday.com. So like, so why we did that? So, I mean, I think the biggest thing that, you know, we've talked a lot about numbers and stuff, but you know, no media business is good without great content. The product has to be great. And I think it's easy to forget that when you like are an operationally minded person. But like what I've realized, like when Trunk started The Hustle, that shit just changed. It just got better. And like I've seen that happen numerous times when working with companies. Like there's just a difference of quality. Everything changes. Churn goes down. Revenue per user goes up. Inbound advertising goes up. People just organic growth goes up. Also, it's just like more fun. Like, you're like, this is great. And when assessing kind of the landscape, and Becca, my co-founder, and I really looked at every part, every kind of industry out there. I looked at children's entertainment. I literally looked at everything. You know, I think the opportunity that we saw was like, what type of content is underserved or lacking like true quality? And we think B2B was that space. And there are, like I said, there's some great publications out there that do great journalism. And I think that's been the investment that a lot of these like traditional legacy media companies, as well as like net new ones, Aging Media and Skiff, like they're great businesses. And I love what they do. It's very journalism driven. And that's like a game. That's a totally different game to play, right? Like you have to have the best sources, Scoop, Semaphore, what they're doing, right? You can build a great business that way. It's really tough. And I don't really know how to do that either. And so what we realized was like, can we have category leading content by unlocking like the asset that's scarce is insights of people doing the job. And if we can unlock that asset and make it not scarce, and then purposely like make it free content and like flip the model on its head where like, I mean, I can't tell you how many people are like, why don't you charge for this? This is insane. Happens all the time. That was like the whole goal, is like, let's disrupt basically this space with like insights that never have been really consistently shared before because of how we set up our model. And then second, let's not charge for it. So then we can take over the market and then have a downstream, down funnel kind of strategy to capitalize.
We've mentioned the word unit economics a couple of times. Could you maybe break down the difference in unit economics between a B2B newsletter, for example, ideally kind of what some of your newsletters might be seeing versus B2C in general? Or just give us an example so we can kind of understand that better.
So one, on a churn level, most consumer things are nice to haves, not needs to haves. So typically consumer oriented content just has higher churn. And so I love regulated industries. I love that. It's like need to read. If you can help people make more money or be better at the job, your churn's lower. So, you know, when thinking about unit economics, there's really only like two equations. It's what is the churn and how much revenue per user do you make a month? And then like the rest is then, you know, payback, it's CACs if you have those. And so from a churn level, I identified it as being like much lower naturally if the content, especially if the content's amazing, but just naturally B2B versus B2C, I think is better. Then the second is on the revenue per user side. You know, selling B2B is like a wildly different process, and it's just, you know, no one's been able to crack the code of like programmatic B2B, because like, it's like saying like, hey, you know, you go to a C store and buy a candy bar. Like, do you go to C store and just like make a decision around like $100,000 piece of software? Like, no. So like that sales cycle is different than like the way you have to sell it is different. And so like that, the market it differently. And so, you know, it is very different, but you know, the math is fairly simple. You know, at Spiceworks, like we, on average, when I was there, we only sold to IT vendors, right? But my like average cost per click was like $13-15. And I mean, my clients spent $6.5 million a year with me. It was, you know, they were happy at that rate. And that's what happens when you're buying 50K of laptops every year, like, sure. And so, you know, it just changes because of the purchasing power. It changes how much you can charge for ads. And so on average, I think it's anywhere between 5 and 10 times higher, I think, on a revenue per user basis for ads typically, is what I would say. Like the elite ones are 10, the like good ones are 5. And so, you know, lower churn, higher ARPU, you're going to have much better LTV, greater business. Now, the question is CACs, like how do you grow that audience? You know, you would assume, you know, getting a healthcare system executive that runs as 100,000 employees, like probably not the same CAC as like a 22-year-old interested in AI and crypto, right? So, there's a difference of like how much you acquire that person for, but that's where having great content comes into play, right? Like if you are unlocking an asset of content that we don't think exists anywhere else, that's what we believe, you have better word of mouth, you have better organic growth, you have like more referrals. Well, like then that makes your cost for a customer very, very efficient. So, and then I think competition too, just bluntly, there's like less people that in B2B that can spend the time to create content consistently, because like they're working, they're like doing all this, where like if you're a gamer, you can kind of create content while you do the thing, you know, it's just like different. So I think competition's like drastically lower as well.
Are there any numbers, and this is broad across different categories, any numbers you can share on CPM for the sponsorships that you're selling in a newsletter, or what B2B newsletters see?
We're like around like probably 150 average.
That's really helpful. Because everybody asked about like sponsorship pricing, especially when they're just kind of starting out. So it's good to get some data.
Yeah. I mean, to be very honest, I don't think people could sell that without a world-class sales team. I think if I was a newsletter writer, I'd probably settle for like 50, even like 25, to be honest. But like, yeah, this is like, you know, having relationships. I was in LA last night for 18 hours to go meet with like the CMO of a B2B SaaS company, and we went to Nobu and had dinner. Like, that's a very different experience of having that to work on a deal that then can get those kind of rates. Like, there's a different level of commitment and relationships, and that's what you have to do, I think, on those sides. So it's not all, I truly don't believe most people can just like walk in and do that. And the other factor is like, when you have those kind of rates, your reporting better be really fucking good. And most, no offense to most of the newsletters right out of there, like on the hobbyist side, but they're just reporting clicks ain't going to do it.
Let's dive into sponsorships for a second, because there's most of the listeners are probably more on the beginner side. And so they're like, how do I sell my first sponsorship, or how do I get the process going, or what do I even price it at? You probably have more experience in sponsorships and partnerships than anybody we've talked to on this podcast. And so can we just maybe just imagine an avatar of someone who has 10,000 newsletter subscribers? They think sponsorships could be a good business model for them. How should they think about making money from sponsorships or selling their first sponsorships?
I mean, the first thing I would do is like work on like Beehive's programmatic network, like a legit, I mean, like if your fill rate zero, your fill rate is zero. You make no money. There's also a second factor of selling sponsorships, which is creating the habit of the reader. I think like the biggest mistake people make is like not putting an ad in all the time. One, it creates FOMO for other advertisers. It looks like you're always sold out, and it does work. That's a great sales tactic strategy. But more importantly, it trains the reader like, this isn't like a one-off thing. This is an exception. I'm not selling out today. Like, no, this is like part of why you get this. And like creating that habit with that consumer is like really important. So that's the first thing, is like solidify your foundation of like, how can I make sure my inventory is filled as much as humanly possible? And then, I mean, the second one is like, we do this all the time, is like, the first question I ask is, who don't you want to work with? So we have block lists with every creator. So we work with that, you know, some of them are 30 companies long and some of them are like three, but you don't want to know who you don't want to work with. I think it's like really helpful from a audience perspective. Again, like prioritizing them first matters, and like creating your boundaries and values there. And then the second one is like, if you're not your own audience, like if you're truly not your own audience, like you may think you are, but you're not, which I think happens a lot. But if you're not your own audience, you need to go ask your audience, like, hey, what do you spend money on? What do you do? What do you want me to write about? What product launch do you want me to go, you know, evaluate? What review can I give that you think would be interesting? Go talk to them about that. And those are your advertisers. If you are that your own customer, like, what do you buy? What do you want to get reviewed? What do you want to learn about? And then we go to that list. And, you know, I think today, you know, the biggest challenge at like certain sizes is that like, you have to realize that like marketing is not just dollars in, it's also time. And with all the cuts happening, these marketing teams are like literally 30% of the size they used to be. For them to give you an ad and to do that work is the same amount of time if they worked with someone with 100,000 subs or 10,000 subs. Even if the cost is literally 10%, their time is the same. And so now they have to assess like, hey, this is a better CPM, this is a better deal, this is better cost per click. I love this brand, it's really cool, but like, I'm going to get 30 clicks, 50 clicks. Is this worth my time? And I dealt with this at Workweek in the beginning too. Like, I mean, I had an advertiser that worked with me for like 5 years, and she like just out of like pity, I think, gave us money. And she called me a month later. It's like, it's great. Just like call me when you have like 100,000 subs, so it makes it like a little bit worth our time. And scale matters to a point of time. And I think if I was a new newsletter writer and I wanted to like monetize, I would be asking potential advertisers, like, how can I make this as easy as possible for you? Like, I don't want you to take up any time. I'll write the copy. I'll do the brief. Hey, here's the ad I already wrote. What do you think? Like, your factor of blocking is not going to be price at that level. It's going to be time and like professionalism. Like, hey, I need an IO. I need a search warrant. I need like, there's just like things that people have that on a one-on-one basis make it pretty tough.
I want to talk about lead generation B2B because I think a lot of people don't know about this. But I've heard some, you might've said this, might've been someone else, like lead generation is that revenue is some of the lifeblood of many B2B media businesses. Can you tell us just like what that is, how B2B media companies make money from lead generation? And then we'll ask some follow-up questions on that.
Yeah. I mean, lead generation very simply is you are selling an email address to a vendor for them to then go sell to that person, or an email address, maybe first name, last name, company name, et cetera. Hopefully that person has opted into that. Hopefully that person actually wants to be contacted by that vendor. But like almost all B2B sales processes start with what they call MQLs, marketing qualified leads, and then they move to SQLs and then they move through the pipeline and become closed deals. All those leads have to be brought in and purchased somewhere. They can be brought in from like sales reps, just like doing cold outreach. But most of those, most bigger ticket items, sales reps are told what accounts they work and their sales force is populated with leads and their marketing team's job is to drive MQLs. And then the sales team's job is to make them SQLs. And that's the process that works. And in B2B, helping marketers get more leads into their system, particularly leads that are MQLs that are like ready to go, is a very valuable thing and like helps people be more successful at it. And so that is, the cost per lead, hence the like lead gen, is you pay per lead. So it's not unlike CPMs or flat costs where it's kind of more of a flat rate. You just get to pay for performance.
Awesome.
Adam, I know we're coming up on time here. Thanks again for this fantastic conversation. I think it's been, you know, one of the most insightful we've had on the pod. You're obviously one of the most experienced operators out there right now, and certainly one of the most experienced that we've had on the podcast. So where can folks find you? Twitter,
yeah.
LinkedIn, like where can folks find you?
On Twitter, I'm @AdamRY_N. And then I have a podcast called Perpetual and a newsletter as well that I don't publish the newsletter that often, but podcast is more consistent. That's where you can get me.
Awesome. Thank you.